here we are. Welcome back, everyone. We're going to have a very interesting hour of conversation coming up. A lot of information for you as well, as we welcome back Nurse Anne in just a couple minutes. Are you there, partner?
I'm here,
sure.
Jeff.
All right. Did you get your shot today?
No, the line was too long.
Couldn't get in. Same here. I went in again. I didn't know. He says, go online. Make an appointment. We're booked up till November 24th now, I think, something like that. So, you know, have a nice Thanksgiving, and we'll see you then. So Rite Aid is pumping them out. Now, the official numbers are, according to CDC Director Mandy Cohen, 2% of the American population has taken the new updated COVID shot. That's about 7 million Americans. I still am very suspicious about anything that comes out of the government. I listen to George Carlin, believe nothing they say. So whatever the truth is, I don't know. We don't know.
It's, you know, looking at the number of people and you know, at least locally, and you apparently are seeing the same thing there.
Yeah. No,
they're doing 80 to 90 a day here.
I don't know. Don't know. It started out a little slow. These people, where I am, they're just all day long. They're a month booked out, okay? So, and they're not sitting around gathering moss. They're jabbing these people. I watched them. Well, I didn't see the needle go in, but I watched them go into that little death room. Get their shot. We don't know yet if there are going to be many reported immediate negative reactions to these injections. We did hear something about, nosebleeds, kind of gushing nosebleeds. What did you hear about that?
I believe those reports were shedding reports, primarily kids. That are being exposed, you know, from other kids getting the shot or their teachers.
So it wasn't a shot. It's being around the vax. This is not good. Those nosebleeds are awful.
If the nosebleeds are happening, you can assume the menstrual bleeding is probably also happening. And pregnancy losses. You know, the same thing we saw each time they rolled out a new vax and people ran for it.
Eric and I spend some time talking about and speculating what they did with this new injection, which they did not want people to think of as a booster, if you remember. They want to think of it, or have us think of it as a brand new version of the COVID-19 vaccine, which is kind of splitting hairs here, but it's stupid. It's still death in a vial. It doesn't matter.
Well, it's just another variation on the original spike protein. It has different features, obviously.
Right. Very good. Okay, we're going to find out now what it's like in a major northeastern hospital with Nurse Anne, who has been with us for a long time. When she can get free, she's working an awfully difficult routine there. And it's very tired much of the time when she is off, but it's a very demanding and terribly difficult job in these times. And there are other issues now in some of these hospitals that I'm hearing about, which are also causing even more grief for the real dedicated professionals who are nurses, who are not imports from abroad, who are not properly trained. And I'll leave it at that and see what else Nurse Anne wants to say. Are you there, Nurse Anne?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Hi, Anne. Welcome back.
Hello. Hello, Erica.
So it's really nice to have you back on. You are our lifeline to reality in terms of organized commercial medicine in this country, and to keep our literal radio finger on the pulse of what's happening out there. So it's been several months since you've been on. Let's take it from the top. How do you compare what you're seeing now, just in terms of trends and numbers with what you were seeing, which was horrific, the last time you were on? How have things changed?
A lot more has changed because the severity of the ill effects to the vaccines is starting to show up now more than ever before.
So the vaxxed, are coming in now with serious issues to the ER, so it sounds like the chickens are coming home to roost with a lot of people who weren't heretofore disabled to the extent that they had to go to the hospital. Is that fair? Are we seeing a growing wave?
Yeah, and it's very, very serious. It was always serious, but it's exceptionally serious now because we're seeing a lot of complications with bleeding. And it's primarily bleeding in the head. And so we're seeing multiple brain bleeds, and we're seeing multiple strokes, and then which are very severe strokes. They're where patients used to have strokes before and they'd recover from them. They're not recovering from the strokes now. The effects of the stroke are pretty much long term. They have a high fatality rate with the brain bleeds.
Would you please describe a brain bleed for our listeners? It's not a term that people often hear. Go ahead.
The correct terminology would be an intracranial hemorrhage. So, something has to have triggered like a bleed in the brain, and it can happen in any area of the brain. Mm-hmm. Typically, we're seeing it. It's in the middle cerebral artery, but it's also affecting the occipital regions and temporal regions. So what's happening when that happens, people are losing their balance and falling, and then that's complicating things again, because if they hit their head and they already have a bleed, now they've probably just encountered a secondary bleed after they hit the floor or whatever they may have fallen hit. So the bleeds in the brain they can be slow, but by the time they get to the hospital, they're pretty acute and severe. And then the kicker is these people will have other comorbidities, so they won't know they have a bleed in their head, and they're getting treated for possibly a cardiac issue. So they'll be on blood thinners, which now compounds the problem even more. So we're seeing brain bleeds at huge rates now.
So these are hemorrhagic strokes as opposed to ischemic strokes.
But we're also seeing ischemic strokes as well.
Okay.
But there's more of the hemorrhagic.
Okay.
Yeah, on our unit in the last month, most of our stroke patients were hemorrhagic. There was very few that actually had any kind of stroke related to like some embolic nature. Now, that being said, they've also been throwing a lot of blood clots. So the cardiac patients we're seeing on our unit, they're having blood clots in their heart vessels, even though they are on blood thinners and anticoagulation therapy at home. They're still developing the blood clots. So the medication that would traditionally have been used to treat those things are pretty much not effective anymore.
My gosh.
So let me ask you this. Are we still having to put people on gurneys in the hallways? How is the crowd? What is the population of ER and other fast admission channels there? Is it busy as always?
Oh, yeah.
Like around the clock?
Around the clock. The ER is always overflowing. They are always trying to get patients moved to, like either if they try to get them to a rehab facility or get the family to end up taking them home, which is also another problem because they can't. The rehab facilities are getting overloaded now too. So the movement of patients from one area to another is very difficult because the hospital is full every night. And every night that we go in, if we have an open bed, if we have four open beds, they're filled by the morning. And there's still a lot of people in the emergency room waiting to come up to actually be placed into a bed. So they may spend 2 or 3 days down in the ER.
Mm-hmm. How long do they have to wait to be seen and now, approximately? Sometimes it was 10 hours, but is it still that bad?
Yeah, well, the determination is made based on the level of acuity when the EMS services arrive at the patient's homes, mm-hmm. or if they're taking a patient from a facility. So if the patient is coming in and it's a potential stroke, that is a high alert. So the people have to act really quickly on those cases. Like equally so with the if it's a respiratory issue or a cardiac issue, they have to act. They have only a certain window of time that they can actually react. So those patients will be always prioritized as first. But once they're seen and they start the treatment plan on those patients, they may very well be doing that treatment plan in the emergency room in a holding area versus mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. they should be up on an intensive care unit or at least a cardiac unit being monitored.
All right, so what I'm hearing is that the sirens are running all night. The meat wagons are in transit virtually all the time, bringing people in. Do you get, now a lot of people don't know this, but how much information do you get from the incoming paramedic crew with a patient before they hit the ER? Are you getting basics? Mm-hmm. Are they still running blood pressure and things like that on the patients in the transport vehicle?
Oh, yeah. Now, in transit, yes. They immediately treat appropriately. So they will be getting an IV in the patient. They're checking all the vital signs. Usually with stroke patients, you're seeing very, very high blood pressures. And then with the patients that have the hemorrhagic bleeds going on, and they'll still be having very high blood pressures. So the EMS is still treating them. They are treating them appropriately till they mm-hmm. get to the hospital. They may actually even have to start them on medications to try and lower the blood pressure. Sometimes mm-hmm. they'll try, but usually those scenarios, if it's respiratory, cardiac, or stroke, they're already notifying the emergency rooms that we're en route. We have this, and there's a stroke alert.
Got it.
Already warned before the hospital they ever hit the ER doors.
Good. You know, I've always thought, and this goes way back, that our fire, rescue, paramedics, and many of our police, I won't include all of them because there's some real bad cops out there, but the motivation of these people is so positive and so good. They are really, our most heroic class of people. The nurses on the hospital end, the paramedics on the outside end, coordinating to try to bring people to a place where they're going to get stabilized at least. And I just hope that everyone listening understands that. No matter what country you're listening from, your paramedics, your emergency people, your nurses, your doctors, the good doctors, are really heroes. They're in highest service to humankind. So keep it up.
Yeah, I have to give a lot of credit to the EMS and the paramedics because they actually go through grueling training, some of them are better. I would say some of the EMS people are actually better than some of the nurses that practice on the floor because they're just getting constant exposure to critical events every day, day in, day
out. What an education. What an education. Talk about training. It's Okay. Brain bleeds. Not good. The normal routine is to, what, CAT scan of the head? What do they do? How do they get a look inside
so
the brain?
What usually happens is they're presenting and they're saying they're presenting like a stroke patient is what usually happens. They'll say they had weakness or they had visual loss or they lost their balance or something like that. Or also they'll probably even display like they have difficulty speaking. They're not, the family might find them at home not being able to make any sense and are repeating themselves or they can't get the words out. So it's presenting like a stroke. So the thing about it is the it's still high, it's a high critical event. So they put the hospital on stroke alert, the EMS, and they bring the patient in. And then what they're finding out is that once the CAT scan the patient and do all the blood work and all of that, but mainly it's the CAT scan. Once you do this, the CAT scan of the head, you can pretty much, the CAT scan is not always the best diagnostic tool, but in this scenario, it's pretty bang on. You can see the bleed right away.
Yeah.
And then usually once the patients are still in the emergency room or admitted to our unit, they'll end up following it up with an MRI. And the MRI is one of the best diagnostic tools out there to date. And that will confirm what you see on the CAT scan. And
well, what I know...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that having had experience personally with severe brain injury and CAT scans, it's a fascinating field, and I understand what you're describing. I mean, I can see a picture of it. Brain bleeds can be fatal if they're small. I mean, the size of a 25-cent piece. I've seen, I've read about this for a long time. Can kill somebody. That's it. It's small.
Yeah.
Or it can be big.
Yeah.
In my case, my entire cranium was full of blood from being in a horrific car crash. It was an attempt to remove me, and somehow I was sent back, and I'm still here. But I remember going through all of that and not being able to speak well, swallow well for a while. I had to kind of teach myself again how to do that. But fortunately, it came back.
Like a stroke.
I should send you the pictures of my CAT scan. And for those of you out there who don't know, CAT scan will take a picture of a brain. They'll kind of do it in like a stack of papers. They'll go levels deep down in through the brain. Here it is at level 6. Here's what we see. Here's what the CAT shows at level 10, level 20, level whatever. And they go all the way through the brain and take horizontal pictures of it. It's fascinating. And when you have somebody come in without having had a CAT scan, what are the most common things? Are people sometimes unconscious? It must run the whole gamut of conditions.
Well, the thing is they present like they're having a stroke, so like they have difficulty. They'll have difficulty moving their limbs or they'll have visual loss, like I said, and they'll have difficulty sometimes talking or otherwise they can't express themselves and they'll have difficulty swallowing. So it presents like a stroke, but once you do the CAT scan, we're seeing CAT scans now that light up like Christmas trees.
Oh, my.
I mean, you don't even need the MRI now.
Blood
the bleeds
everywhere.
Are so bad and so severe. You don't even, the MRI just confirms everything that the CAT scan saw.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
So the problem with that is that the, it's the, how, what's the extent of the brain bleed then? And that's the biggest issue because can we actually, can we make a difference? Will we be able to save this patient? And that's where it gets very complicated because they may have other heart issues, which requires them to be on blood thinners. But now we're taking them off.
Well, and you're on a blood thinner, you got
scenario,
more bleeding, of course.
You'll have more. Yeah, if you keep them on it, you have an issue with them continuing to bleed. So this has been a very fine line we walk now because we've been faced with this issue. And what we're what's happening is we're seeing people have huge clots in some of their arteries in their heart, and they have a brain bleed as well going on at the same time.
Wow.
So you've got cardiac involved, vascular surgery involved, you've got GI involved, you've got neuro involved, you've got neurosurgery involved. I mean, the amount of people, specialties brought in on each individual case is huge. And now you have to contend with, what do you need to treat? Well, you have to treat the bleed first, because the bleed is the most, the one, unless the blood clot is you know, you have to take them off the blood thinners, but you take the chance that you have, it'll buy you some time, so until the blood gets reabsorbed.
They do a lot of cranial surgery to stop the bleeding, right?
Yeah, they do. They'll end up deciding if they'll need to go to surgery or not. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of craniotomies being performed. And they'll see if they'll wait a day or two to see if the bleed hasn't gotten any worse. So they're doing serial CTs, and if the bleed hasn't gotten any bigger, then they'll kind of wait it out to see if it could be reabsorbed, and try to walk that fine line of not having them on, their anticoagulation.
Well, that's a dice roll.
And I had that patient just this week, actually, so that's one that sticks to mind. He actually had a huge clot in one of his vessels in his heart, but he also had a huge brain bleed as well. So they have to basically decide in order of priority and take the risk. And they tell the family that as well. There's an element of risk, which either way you go. So medicine has been really challenged now.
Right. How many of these people have been injected?
Oh, 100%. They're all injected.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%. Every last one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It sounds like when you have a patient coming in there with some kind of cardiac event and a brain bleed at the same time, it does sound like the entire body is under severe attack from these injections.
Yeah.
It's not just one thing, and then a month later another thing. This is a major assault on the body, it sounds like.
Yeah. And there's a lot of them, a lot of the patients, it's the older patients, unfortunately. We are getting young patients in here too, but it's the older patients that we struggle the most with, because they try so hard to save them, but a lot of people end up going on comfort care, which is very, very tragic, because they just didn't get the hemorrhagic bleed is so big. It's sometimes, unfortunately, we can't do anything about it. And we just had a patient pass away there recently. She was put on comfort care, and she had bleeding in three areas of her brain. And I, as a nurse, I will tell you, usually you would have, at another time in my life when I was much junior to this scene, I would have said, you probably, if you saw one part of the brain bleeding, that would have been, okay, that's a huge concern. And to see three areas of her brain that were actively bleeding was incredible. So this poor woman did not really have a chance. So she ended up going on palliative care, and then it was hospice care after that. And she was in agony. That was the other thing. The level of pain that came with that bleed, those three bleeds was. We were medicating her pretty heavily for pain.
It's a very bad headache. Let me put it mildly. Mm-hmm. Very bad.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible.
And now she's bleeding in three areas, not just one area.
No.
She's three areas of her brain.
I know what you're saying.
It was very. It's very tragic, because she didn't have a fall. This is all related to something else was the trigger that caused that huge amount of bleeding in her head. And the sad part about all of this is nobody's actually telling the patients or saying anything. And it's almost too late anyway, because, I mean, just like you, I go out into the public when I can to go get some grocery shopping, and I see people lining up for the vaccine.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like it's a lost cause. It's like and anyway, they're vaccinated prior, so chances are the previous vaccinations have been causing all this all along anyway. So this one is just the icing on the cake.
Well, we wonder what they've done to tweak it. God only knows. They're not going to tell us. A quick question, then I want to change subjects a little bit. What percent are coming in with cardio and or cerebral problems?
I would say, and this is going to be a high percentage, with both, I would say at least probably 60 to 70% of the patients have both complications.
Both complications? Wow.
Both. And some are younger, and some are, and they, as I said, the older people have the bigger struggle with the mm-hmm. management of how we take care of them.
Mm-hmm. One quick answer. How many are coming in with falls? Big falls.
There's quite a few.
Down.
There's quite a few coming in with falls. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what precipitated the fall, we never know, because they can't tell us because they don't remember it.
Gotcha.
But yes, it's usually, again, that's usually the older population versus the younger population. But I've seen people in their 40s and their 50s coming in, and they are young people. I would consider them young, and they are saying, I don't know what happened. I just passed out, and I woke up on the floor.
On the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Erica?
But the other thing that I should mention, because I haven't mentioned it yet, is we're seeing also brain herniation. So there's been a number of cases also where we're seeing brain herniation, which means the brain matter is going down the spinal cord. It's herniating. And that is usually critical. It's usually a matter
terrible.
Of getting you into surgery right away.
I've not heard of that before. That's weird.
Yeah.
Erica, what do you have? You want to jump in
here?
All right, hold on.
This was one of the things. This was one of the things. I had a guy who came in, and he actually had presented to the ER with the stroke symptoms, but by the time he had got to our unit, this is 3 days later, he's up in our unit, and he's talking, and he's making sense, and he's following all the commands and all of that. And then they had done a CT that morning, and nobody had read it. So finally, when the radiologist read it, they're calling the floor frantically, saying they need to get a number of a neurosurgery. And then all chaos broke out. And before we knew where we were, there was a bunch of doctors on the floor. Neurosurgery was there. They were saying he has to be. They were calling the OR team. They were saying he's absolutely in critical condition, and this is a man who was still talking to me. And they were saying he needs to be brought to the OR right away. He could he was basically herniating.
Wow.
Right there. And it was incredible. I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Erica?
Yeah, that's, was he in pain?
60 to 70%. Coming in with brain and cardio crises.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I guess it's no surprise. You know, we've known all along that this does extensive damage to the blood vessels and the coagulation system. So every organ is going to suffer in some manner. And the nervous system is exquisitely sensitive to drops in oxygen.
Yeah, that's another thing. The O2, their saturations are very low. So the hemoglobin levels we're transfusing blood too, so, you know, there you go. We're, you know, their hemoglobin levels are low, and so now you're transfusing blood. And also,
I don't think
their platelets are very low.
Yeah, I heard that as well. I think the other side of it is they're not perfusing either because of damage to these.
We have to put them on oxygen.
Okay.
Yeah. The people who would normally come from home, they were never on oxygen or placed on oxygen in the hospital. So they're getting supplemental oxygen while they're here at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But something came to mind. Yeah, so that was the other thing. So, yeah, they're definitely... you asked me the question, Erica, was he in pain? He must have had a very high tolerance to pain, but he was in pain, but he wasn't in the type of pain that I thought he should have been in. But most all the others presented with having a lot of pain. He was a unique case. I have no idea how that man survived through the night, because when I come to find out how dangerous this situation was, and how close it came to actually the potential of losing him. He actually survived. But, yeah, brain herniation cases are also coming in the mix as well, which is very, very dangerous. And the odds are against us, and timing is a huge factor, that it's found quickly.
Wow. All right, let's look at the cancer side of this nightmare. What are we seeing? We're getting reports from Dr. William Mackus and others, Ryan Cole, very articulate reports about a tsunami of cancer in all ages. Teenagers showing up with colorectal cancer, crazy things that you'd never see before. It seems like these injections are now, again, beginning to manifest. They're fused. They're different in everybody. But people who have been able to get along with discomforts, with symptoms that are not pleasant, are now really getting hit with big things. That's what it seems like. Cancer is one of them. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. So in the arena of cancers, we're seeing brain tumors, lung cancer, breast cancer, liver cancer, and... there hasn't been, I haven't had a case where we've seen much colon rectal cancer, but that's not to say it's not there. And every age has been affected. That is 100% correct. That is a true statement. Every age is affected. And then, and the thing is, the people who are presenting with these will almost always tell you there's no record of cancer in the family. There wasn't any indication that they needed to worry about that. And the other side of the coin is the people who actually had cancer previously, in maybe 10 years, 20 years back, had it in remission, now has explosive cancers all over, all different types of cancer, all over the body.
Are these cancers being found incidentally, or you know, while being worked up for what they think is something else?
Yeah, that's the thing. The people who are coming in through the emergency room, the cancer has been found after they're doing the diagnostics. There's a couple of things that are off. Either they see it on a CT scan or an MRI, or they'll do an echocardiogram and they'll find some sort of a mass, or they'll do some sort of a CT scan of the body, and they'll find a questionable mass, unsure if it's carcinogenic. Once they have one area of cancer, almost always there's another area of cancer somewhere else in the body. There's usually two, maybe even three sites. So if they have one, they have at least two or three more sites where there's cancer.
Boy, oh boy.
This is a remarkable assault on a living organism. I'm amazed at what I'm hearing.
How's the morale of the staff? Are they holding up?
No, it's actually getting to the point where everybody's pretty beat up, and everybody's very tired. There's a lot of we're working a lot of overtime. I did six shifts last week, and there are some people that are working like anything from 12 to 15 days in a row. I can't do that, but there are people who are doing that, and these are like 12 hours of overnight. One shift is 12 hours. Yeah. And night shift, day shift is bad enough, but a night shift is a killer because you're up all night long.
So you worked 72 hours last week.
Yeah.
In one run.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been very challenging. The hospital, the problem is they're struggling to get permanent staff, which was the issue anyway. So they went into an emergency contract where they had the hospital basically got the government agencies to involve so that they would actually get a company to come in and staff the hospital because they couldn't find the staff to put on as a regular staff for that facility. So a lot of travel nurses was called in for that. And it has been consistently that way. They cannot find people who want to work in the nursing industry anymore. And then finding the trained nurses with the skill set that's needed for these high level of acuity floors is very, very difficult and very challenging. So they've gone and they've gone outside of the U.S. and started taking in nurses.
I've read accounts of this, that they're coming in here from semi-third world countries in some cases, and they're not trained properly. And they have great deficiencies in their knowledge, which can pose clear dangers to some of the patients.
Yeah.
Is this true?
It is very problematic. They're bringing in nurses that into a high acuity arena, and they're not capable of taking care of the patients. For one, they do not know how to read telemetry, which is a key piece for people who have cardiac issues. They're on
EKGs.
Heart monitors, EKGs, and telemetry monitors. You have to be able to know and identify those rhythms, because if you don't, then you're going to run into huge issues, and it may be too late. But the thing is that usually there's other nurses, like myself. There's three other nurses there that can identify with the rhythms. But we already are overworked, so we have our own patient caseload, and now we're babysitting nurses who don't have the skill set and should not be in that area of nursing, and probably not in nursing at all, some of them.
Bad attitudes,
and they haven't got the skill set. They can't identify when a patient could be potentially going into a critical situation. And we had one very recently. This was very, very worrisome. We had one, a nurse who I don't know if she ever saw the patient for 4 hours, but by on the fifth hour, the patient was seizing, and when she was called into the room when we called a code, she didn't know anything about the patient's history. Well, I have five patients to take care of. My other partner has her five patients, and then so we're two of the nurses on that unit that actually can identify with rhythms and things like that. Well, we don't know anything about her patient because that's her patient. So when she's called into the room to tell the doctor what's going on, what's the history, how did she present, was she normal, was this her normal baseline, she couldn't give any of that information. So in all honesty, all I have to say on that matter is she did not go in and see the patient. she did not see that patient for 4 hours. She never saw that patient. The only person that went in was the nursing aide, and thank God for the nursing aide, because the nursing aide that was in there had had conversations with the patient, knew the patient was alert and oriented, and was basically the patient had said to the doctor, the patient had told her she was looking forward to getting out of the hospital, spending time with her family. Our grandkids were coming from out of town, and she was looking forward to it. The patient had a huge, massive seizure. The nurse has no idea how long she was seizing for, because it was the nurse's aide who discovered her, and the nurse who was taking care of her didn't know anything about the patient's chart, history, or what kind of medication she had been on. So I believe the nurse never went and saw the patient.
Oh, it sounds
like it.
That's
what I believe.
What I'm hearing is, and I'm speaking nationwide now, is that this kind of profile is common. Out-of-country, third-world nurses coming in without proper training, not being fully vetted even, getting this big money, it's a lot of money, and actually causing the deaths of patients. It happens. I'm hearing that.
Yeah. Well, this patient ended up we had to code this patient, and we had to intubate her, and because we couldn't, she was obtunded, which means her airway was blocked. So we had to basically put her on life support. This is not to knock any certain nurses down, but if you're going to be in the field of nursing, then do it genuinely because you care about the person in the bed. Because that person could be your loved
profession.
One the next time.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
And it's very, very tiring now, because the nurses who actually have the skill set are getting burnt out. I'm tired. I'm gone beyond tired at this point. And when I'm not there, it's a relief to me, but it's a huge stressor to the other nurses who have to struggle to carry their workload and possibly babysit the nurses who don't actually know what they're doing.
Well, you're obviously one of the main pillars upon which this whole paradigm sits in your particular hospital. You're very strong, and I can see how the others are getting fried. I also hear that hospitals are now begging nurses who quit rather than take the bioweapon injection. Yes.
Yeah, they are. Even this hospital. This hospital was guilty of forcing their staff to go and get injection. And so they lost a lot of staff, and then the staff moved on, and now here we are, and they're begging them to come back. And these nurses have moved on. They've gone and done something else with their lives, or maybe they just, they feel like early retirement is a good thing. And that's the other thing. The skill set is gone. The older, well-educated nurses that came in you had to know your stuff. When I came on, when I was a nurse, I was basically told, you're going to be in med-surg for 2 years. You better be able to keep your nose clean and make sure you build your skill set to the ability where if you plan on moving somewhere else to a higher acuity field in nursing, that you can prove that you can do it and manage it. So you actually had to prove yourself back when I was coming up the ranks. And so I had to put my time in for 2 years of med surg. Well, now you have travel companies saying, well, all you need is a year. If you want to. So all they're doing is they're coming out of nursing school, they're going in, getting a year of training under their belt, and then they're going traveling, and they've been placed in these high acuity areas, like step-down units, cardiac units, and then ICU units, and it's over their head, and they're drowning. But they won't turn it down either. They won't admit to the fact that they lack the skill set because they want the paycheck. And equally so, the nurses are not just at fault for this. I believe the companies too. There's one company in particular that that I question their practices because I wonder because they're supposed to administer testing to these nurses before they're brought on board to any hospital anywhere in the country, and they're supposed to have a passing rate where they can actually pass those tests. If they can't pass those tests, they shouldn't be going into those fields. So I think that the company is also somehow fudging the numbers.
It sounds like the system is beginning to fragment the whole thing.
It's very broken. It's very broken, and we have very few successes. We have more issues where there's more of a depressive kind of state, and there's it's too late. You can't do anything about it.
You're losing a lot. You're losing more patients than usual, it sounds like.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. So if you see patients going somewhere else and they get to walk out of the hospital doors, that's a big day. That's a big day.
Wow.
And there's a lot less of that happening now. They're exceptionally sick.
That's not what you signed up for in the beginning, was it? You signed up
No.
to heal people and send them back home to live a relatively normal life. And that's just not happening now. What do you,
no.
Maria?
The part that annoys me the most about it all is when I would try to reach out and educate some of the patients or more so their families, if I got any pushback about talking about the injection in any manner, then I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere with that family. And I might have saw that family 6 months ago, trying to talk to them about it, and now they're surfing back into my ER, and their family member now is laying on a gurney with a massive brain bleed and possibly now coming out of this hospital.
Oh, my. And so we're seeing a real change in the trend. We're seeing more severe, more catastrophic medical issues, and these people are just not making it. And they're all vaxxed. They're all shot up.
Yeah, they're all shot up, and a lot of them that are shot up are all every one of them that has circled through in the last month has recently got their next booster. One of them, and then one of them was saying to me, "Oh, and one of the family members, they didn't get their flu shot yet." And I was thinking, when is enough going to be enough?
I know it.
I just want to shake them and say, can you not see what's happening? I mean, do you not see that your loved one was once healthy and then all of a sudden now they're sick all the time or they've been here for a stroke 3 months ago and now they're back here with a massive stroke and a brain bleed? Why are you missing the picture? Can't you see what's happening?
All right, we have just about a minute or so left. Trends, do you see this in the next, let's say, year and a half, really picking up steam and a lot more people checking out, as it were?
We're going to lose a lot of people. We're going to lose a lot of people, Jeff. We've already lost a lot of people. We're losing a lot of people. The hospitals are struggling to save people at this point. If they're all honest, and if they would actually speak up and really say what the underlying problem was, we might be able to make a difference. But I think even now it's probably too late.
Well, once you've gotten that shot, you don't detoxify it. It's there,
no.
And it's doing its satanic dirt, and it's not going to stop.
No.
So the vax injured are not getting well. That's another way to sum this up.
Yeah, the vax injured are not getting well. They're actually getting sicker. And not only that, they're not just getting sicker. They're actually dying. And it's across the board. It's young, middle-aged, old. It's not just the elderly anymore.
It's no longer under discussion. those injections, as we have always said they were, are designed to do one thing, destroy life. They are biological weapons. They have nothing to do with being a vaccine. Go ahead.
But the thing that gets me the most is, like, when I meet somebody who, you know, who says they're a believer and a Christian and everything like that, and I give them that one line in the Bible that says the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I give that's the one key line that you just have to remember, because everything that we're seeing now is directly related to blood.
To the blood.
And I talked about this 2 years ago when we were saying about describing the blood, trying to draw it out of the patients.
Same
what
thing.
What it looked like.
Same thing now.
Same thing.
Mm-hmm. Which is, for you newcomers, a very dark blue-black sludge-like blood that often clots as it's being withdrawn on a withdrawal basis. This is astonishing, really. Well, Anne, thank you very much for being here and for doing all that you do and for the lives you've touched and for the lives you've saved. I wish we had a million more like you. We'd be much the better for it. Erica?
Yes, thank you, Anne. You're incredibly
welcome.
Appreciated. And we think about you often, being in the trenches. Mm-hmm. Very brave and tenacious and indomitable. We love you.
All right. Yes, we do.
I do love talking to you guys, but I'll tell you, it's been very hard. This has been a very hard road I've taken, and I'm trying very hard to help people, but I hope, and for maybe for every 1 in 100 that I might get reached to, there's so many more I'll never get to. And that's the sad part. I'm not going to make a difference now. I feel it's almost a losing battle.
I understand. And the last thing I should mention very quickly is that cause of death on death certificates, they have a basket full of things that they can write on that certificate, and you'll never see the words Pfizer or Moderna vaccination. You won't see it. So the statistics from the government, forget them. They're lies.
Oh, yes. And that was the other thing I wanted to tell you. The COVID has come back. And also, the treatment regime is still the same. So remdesivir is the drug choice for treating.
Oh, yes.
And I went into work the other night, and I said, did you all know that there is an actual class action lawsuit right now in California for the use of remdesivir for COVID patients?
Oh, they wouldn't know.
Because I want the word out. I want people to know.
All right. Anne, thank you. So, rest. Take care of yourself. And we'll be here when you're ready to come back. Thank you again.
Okay. All right. You're welcome. You have a good night.
Thank you, Anne. Good night.
Thank you. All right. Okay, partner. We've got to wrap it up. We're running late here. That was another eye-opener.
Very enlightening.
Everyone understands that this thing is worse than ever, or it's just going by the plan. That was the plan. All right.
Totally predictable. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Okay. Good night.
Okay, Jeff. Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Be right back with another hour. Hang on.